This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Phil Donahue, the creator and host of daytime TV's most popular talk show. TV talk shows around the country have tried to copy the Donahue show's style, although the program is sometimes given over to standard morning show fare like celebrity interviews and fashion tips. Donahue specializes in tackling controversial social, political, sexual, and religious issues. He introduced subjects that were taboo on most TV talk shows, like homosexuality and transsexuality. Donahue describes himself as a chauvinist turned feminist. He's been coached in the theory and practice of feminism by his second wife, actress Marlo Thomas. Phil Donahue is the author of a best-selling autobiography. His new book, The Human Animal, which is the companion to a TV series of the same name, surveys what the experts have to say about human nature. The Donahue Show went on the air in 1967 in Dayton, Ohio. It went into syndication in 69, moved to Chicago in 74, and is now broadcast from New York. Phil Donahue has said that a key to the show's success is the active participation of the studio audience. I asked him why he first involved the audience in his program.
Well, first of all, I'd like you to believe that I was brilliant enough to sit down and decide to do all these things. Our show, like life itself, evolved. I replaced a variety show in Dayton, Ohio in 1967, and in so doing inherited an audience that had already received tickets for a program that includes song, dance, piano, and also you got to wave when the camera turned on you. Rather than dismiss the audience, why we invited them to come in and watch as I interviewed Madeline Murray O'Hare. I honestly don't remember how long it took, but after several shows, it was clear that what was happening during the commercials was in many ways more interesting and instructive than was happening between the host and the guest. And on one day, I jumped out of the chair and went into the audience, and it was really that moment is what we didn't know it then, what subsequently made the program, different and, I think, absorbing enough to hold a viewer for an hour.
There are other conventions that you violated, too, like turning the show over to issues instead of just doing fashion shows and dieting.
Right. That, too, was a matter of survival. Since our show came from Dayton, Ohio, we did not have the stars that we were accustomed to seeing on talk shows available to us. So, and we had 5 days a week to fill. And what we discovered very early on was that if the issue was right, you could have a show that was far more interesting with a guest who did not have celebrity stature. And it was 1967, the war was raging, protests, our cities were burning, Martin Luther King had been assassinated, as had Bobby Kennedy. And Suddenly, we found that we were surrounded by some very volatile ideas and conflicts about which the audience cared very deeply. It was our first real exposure to the fact that out there during the daytime were a lot of people who wanted more than just games and soaps, women who were concerned about more than just covered dishes and needlepoint, and women who were, in effect, saying, please don't patronize us, just give us the information, we'll make our own decision. And we were off to the races.
Were you ever at all disappointed that you were going to be on in the morning, knowing that the morning audience is always called the housewife audience?
Well, that stereotype existed, the prejudice continued, and I think continues today, although I don't think it's as widespread nor is it as powerful as it once was.
What does that mean in broadcasting terms when they say it's the housewives who listen? What does that mean to broadcasters or to broadcasting executives?
I think, first of all, it means a woman with hair curlers, perhaps sitting under a hairdryer and reading a movie magazine. It also means a very important marketing target, a person who buys everything that Procter & Gamble produces. And it also means, sadly, a person who doesn't have much of an interest in politics or much of a vision beyond the front lawn. I really don't think that overstates the very damaging stereotype that existed within the broadcasting industry at the time. And we were very pleased. One of the things about which we're most proud is that the program demonstrated that those were the audience during the day wanted a program like ours for a long time, and we were just fortunate enough to come along and give it to them.
Were you advised not to do that, though? Were you told, look, Phil, wise up, they don't want to hear about issues. You got to do celebrities and cosmetics.
That advice continued for quite a while. As you may know, we did not burn the town down immediately. We did well in Dayton, Ohio, But the thought of syndicating our program was really an absurdity. We had no desk, no couch, no band, no Phyllis Diller, no funny sidekick. We had really none of the conventions. Our program was also very visually dull. We had no spinning wheel. We were surrounded by programs wherein contestants were dressed like chicken salad sandwiches, or a man said, come on down, and you had all kinds of excitement and the possibility of winning a car, or in those days, maybe $5,000. Against this kind of energy, it took, at the very least, some chutzpah. It made us very nervous. I have to say that I was nervous myself. Well, when we finally syndicated in 69, we got into 3 markets, and then 6, and then 4. And then 8, and then 5. We stuttered and stopped and started again. And on those occasions when we would get flat, we had a lot of pressure to throw pies, as you might say, to juice the show up, to make it more interesting. There was also a lot of resentment about a lot of resistance to the notion that the attention span of the viewer would be long enough to hold one guest for an hour. As you know, the book about television or the audience today is make sure you do it in 6 minutes and then bring on the talking Pekingese. And we disproved them.
You hadn't really considered much about feminism in 1967 when you started doing the show. Looking back now, when you look at your early days of hosting and compare it to your way of doing it now, do you think that you were doing anything then that you'd now think of as being patronizing? Or chauvinistic?
I'm sure that I did. I was raised in a, pardon my voice, I've got a cricket that'll go away in a moment. I was raised in a world where men led and women served. All of the people in my childhood who had any authority at all were males, including the priests and the who said mass while I served. The adult nun who taught me, a woman, was not permitted on the altar, while I, a child, was permitted to serve Mass. And I think that I discovered, probably too late, that these experiences leave a legacy which do not depart from the soul very easily. And to this day, I think I'm struggling with those early experiences. I just had the good fortune of having a professional life that allowed me to meet people like Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and others, who said, among other things, that children in this culture get too much mother and not enough father. When they said that, they made me very nervous indeed, because it was certainly true in my case. And I think to this day I have a tendency to perhaps, I think patronizing habits die a very slow death, and I know that I'm capable of that behavior now and then. I'm not as bad as I used to be.
You're sometimes called TV's leading feminist or morning TV's only feminist or things like that. And I wonder if you have any ideas about why women on TV don't seem to be able to identify themselves as feminists. Sometimes I think that for a woman to identify herself as a feminist who's in broadcasting, it's seen as something that might compromise her professionalism.
I suppose you could say, I've never thought about it, your question provokes the possibility that that it is easier for a male to be a feminist than a woman. At least you get the possibility that your daughter will be exposed to ideas that you want her, that remind her that it's important that she be an independent person, forsake the Cinderella fairy tale, be capable of accommodating her own needs on her own in the event that she makes a bad choice in terms of a relationship or a marriage. And at the same time, you get whatever comfort might come from the fact that a male is making these points, since all the years of most of us in my age group have featured males in positions of authority. Interesting possibility. I don't know. I think the point should be made that the fact that I am considered to be this leading male feminist is itself indicting. I embraced the politics of the feminist movement a long time ago for selfish reasons. First of all, I have a daughter. But I certainly can't claim to have the academic credentials or the informed historical perspective of feminist politics that a lot of other people who don't happen to have the good fortune of having a talk show might have. So it's really, I think, a sign of this enormous struggle that after all this work that these women, many of whom were out there early getting whistled at and having their sex preference questioned and who were really being derisively treated by a largely male press, look up 20 years after this wave has already been underway and discover that their number one male or that one of their leading male supporters is Phil Donahue. I'm not mock humble at all when I say that I didn't wake up one morning and decide to be a feminist. It's been a very difficult struggle. It's very hard to walk away from all the free services that women have provided me all my life. My mother never missed a meal, and I went right from her to a wife who never missed a meal and also dutifully raised five children while I went out and did what you did in the 50s. I got promoted and worked. I was a workaholic, and now I realize that in that process I was not a party to shared parenthood, and I think that the losers in that case were my children.
You've written in your autobiography a couple of years ago about how during your first marriage, you know, you were a much more conventional in your attitude towards gender. And I sometimes think about how your first wife must feel now, hearing all this talk about Phil Donahue, Mr. Feminist, when she was married to, you know, pre-feminist Phil Donahue and saw the earlier
I think she probably feels, I think it's probably, it's a painful thing for her. I made it clear who I was and who I wasn't in my autobiography. It'd be better if someone else said this, but I think it's a reasonably honest review of who I was and wasn't in the early days of our marriage, in the early years of our marriage. What has happened, I think, is that media has, I think, in a kind of short-circuit way, presented me as the single father, who this, who that. Single fathers get a lot more attention than single mothers. Single mothers are supposed to be wonderful. Single fathers are little boys lost that you just kind of want to love, and isn't he struggling to do a nice job? What a wonderful guy he must be. I really feel pretty good about my single fatherhood, having presided over the household while my sons were going through high school. But I do not deserve the award of Father of the Year. I was scared. I really didn't. My father was a fellow who worked 9 to 9 selling furniture. So while he loved me and was a very civil, gentle, insightful man, he was, because of his workaholism, an absentee father in many ways. So I really didn't have a whole. I was a very, very uneasy single parent. And while I did struggle through it, and I'm very grateful for the relationship that I enjoy with my children today, I wasn't what you would. I wasn't the father that my billing might suggest today.
I want to ask you just another question about being a male feminist hosting a controversial talk show, and that is, I see a certain paradox in it that holds a certain trap, and I want to ask you how you respond to that trap. And the paradox is that as a man who is a feminist, who is in a way educating the audience about feminist issues, the trap is that it can, in its own way, perpetuate the relationship of the man as teacher, the woman as student, the man as the enlightener, the woman as the person who is led by that teacher. Is that something that you've thought about, that possible paradox? And if so, like, what do you do in considering it to avoid that trap?
It isn't so much a trap as it is the reality of finding yourself in what appears to be essentially a contradictory position. There's no doubt about it that the tube, you know, if our daughters are to respect women in authority, we better get us some more women in authority. And all I can do is acknowledge that I recognize this apparent contradiction, ask people, including feminists, not to penalize me because I've had the good fortune of developing an audience on television, and to remind them, patronizing as it dangerously might sound, that almost all of the creative ideas which are generated for our program are come from women. But the point has to be made. I get the attention, and there's a good deal of a gap between my income and theirs.
My guest is Phil Donahue, and he's, by the way, written a new book titled The Human Animal. I remember once speaking to a television producer who'd just been hired to do a local morning TV talk show. And I said to him, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to try to do a show like Phil Donahue or a show very different from Phil Donahue? Because I think he was on Up Against You. And he said, are you kidding? We're going to out Donahue Donahue. The show was discontinued not too long after he took over. But I wonder if you run into that in cities around the country, people, producers who think that they're going to out Donahue Donahue.
Well, I'm almost afraid to analyze this because once you do, then it becomes arch and self-conscious. But I do think that there is a unconscious effort to control the audience in an officious kind of way. It's not with malice, and no discourtesy is intended. But we are just a little bit too organized, in my view, in those programs that feature audience participation. This point should also be made. I think there is way underneath, running through the mentality of many of the decision makers in the broadcasting industry, a disrespect for studio audiences and in some cases a disdain. Studio audiences, in the view of these people, most of whom are male, are overweight, not too smart, and are sure going to slow your show down. They don't know television. You do. They don't. They're just the public. I've been on remotes where we've had ropes, and the people had to stay on the certain side of the rope. And pretty soon, there's a sort of shepherd mentality, and these people are treating the audience in a very impersonal way. I have more than one occasion I've had to close the door and give a long speech about how the attitude of the public or the people as they come and gather for my program is extremely important to the success of this enterprise. I don't want to have to go out there and make a comeback because somebody's been treated insensitively. And then after they get in, I think there's I think pace is very, very important. Without malice, I think a lot of people stand up, and if you don't watch them, they'll talk too much, as I may be doing right now.
Oh, no, you're not. But, you know, I think that you get, from your audience, just very short and perceptive questions, which is the opposite of what usually happens in radio or TV audience participation shows. So what are some of the things that you do to organize it in that way? Because you are doing something. It's not right. The way it always happens.
Well, first of all, I never abandon the audience for the hour that we're on the air. I spend the minutes each. We have five breaks, each of which is 2 minutes in length, during which time I am all over the studio schmoozing, for lack of a better term. In effect, I'm going to the back row and saying, are you awake? It's not quite that bold or inelegant, but that's really what I'm doing. I am teasing. I am engaged in some mock self-deprecation. I am saying to them, in effect, we are serious about your participation in this program. If I had any brains, I'd do this by myself. It's a better program if you participate. You look thinner on the air. That usually gets a laugh. Similarly, I make it very clear to the guests, many of whom are very talk show savvy people, without patronizing them and hoping not to insult their intelligence, that while I appreciate they know a lot about media, that this is different. I beg them to recognize that the program is going to be over like mad. Failing to say that to some guests who may come to our program from, for example, a 6-minute interview on Good Morning America, they look up and see an hour, and they try to be William Jennings Bryan. And I try very gently and politely to say, you can't be. You don't have to perform. You be yourself. Please give us as much energy as is consistent with your personality or comfortable for you. People hear what they say. But please remember that while I have a responsibility to you, I also have a responsibility to this audience. They've waited a long time for their tickets. They fought the subway. They got in Midtown at 9 o'clock in the morning. I want them to be glad they came. We would like a community to develop between us and them.
When you go out to the audience with your microphone, you seem to know right where you're heading.
Well, I don't go to someone who doesn't indicate an interest in getting up. I think that's an abusive thing to do. I think that's, you know, I'm not going to somebody's mother and pull them out of their seat by their hair and demand that they be brilliant. I think that's very, very unfair. So I do ask for an indication of support. Only rarely will I go up to someone without that indication.
One of the things you always say on your show, and I think you say it before the show starts too, when you're just alone with the audience, you say things like, help me out here. And what's your purpose in doing that? You don't really seem to need any verbal help in phrasing a thought.
Well, it is a true statement. It's become a kind of, maybe it started as an idiosyncratic piece of behavior, but I mean, I am saying the truth. I can't do this by myself. It just isn't going to sit up and dance in the daytime schedule with two talking heads. It won't work. Nobody in this competitive place is going to be able to make that a marketable vehicle.
How many books does being on your show sell, according to the
publishing
industry?
Well, we have had our share of attention for that. The New York Times has done a couple of articles about it. I hope you won't think me vain for saying we are hot with publishers. We have apparently brought some books up from the ashes, and not a few have wound up on the bestseller list as a result of appearing on our program. You know, by the time the show's over, if we're any good at all at deciding what the people want to hear, you want that book.
My guest is Phil Donahue, and you've done many controversial shows. And because your show is on in the morning, I know a lot of people object to a certain kind of controversy in the morning because the children are home or the children are awake. Do you think that that's a valid reason to change the content to prevent controversy on your program?
I really don't, although this is a tough sell. You know, if you oblige me to consider children and their response to what I program, then, you know, you're going to distill me down to slides and organ music. We have a show that's by adults and for adults. The notion that children are sitting out there absorbed for 1 hour about a transsexual lifestyle is, I think, not consistent with reality. If anything, kids are bored by my show. Those who aren't in their pre-adolescent or adolescent years, I think, would benefit by it because I think we present these sensitive issues responsibly. But again, I don't claim to be your most objective witness.
There have been local stations that have blacked out some of your programs, either portions of it or they've played a rerun instead of carrying the regular show. And I guess some of the subjects have been showing an abortion, showing a birth. Do you approve of them doing it? Do you think that that's... well, obviously you don't, but do you think it's an example of, democracy in action or the opposite?
I do. I think this... I think the syndicated method of distribution of program material is the most democratic. We paid our dues for this. Not being on a network means that one vice president can't, while he's shaving on a Tuesday morning, decide that we're finished. Peoria can cancel our show, but I'm still on the air in Indianapolis. At the same time, individual stations can make a decision about what they may or may not want to broadcast. While it is true we have a contract to provide a program to them, they have no obligation to broadcast it. They are responsible for what goes off the top of their tower, and they retain the last final word on whether this or that program airs. I think that's as democratic as you get in our business. On those occasions when someone cancels our show, I do call them. I mean, I think I make it clear, look, you're the customer, and if you and I are going to have a fight here, you're going to win. It's your station. But please let me appeal this. We wouldn't have sent you this program if we thought it wasn't a broadcast quality. And then I attempt to engage them in a dialogue about why they did it and why we did it. And I think it serves to let them know that we're not cavalier about people canceling the program, and the next time they think about it, at least they'll know that we're watching them.
This is a weird question, but do you ever worry that you're so good at doing what you do that you're going to be doomed to do it forever?
Well, you know, if that's the biggest problem, that, this is a great job. And when you look at the faces of the people on the bus and you realize that the vast majority of us go to work and ply a trade for which perhaps we are not fairly remunerated, many people report to bosses who have less talent than they do. Many people are locked into dead-end jobs. Many women out there with magnificent enlarged brains will never really succeed without really typing. And not to mention racism and sexism and all the other isms that make life so difficult in the marketplace. Here I am getting all this attention, signing these autographs. The money's great. You know, if this is the only thing I could ever do, I'll tell you this, life could have been worse for little Phil Donahue from Cleveland, Ohio.
Our time is about up. Now, if this were your show, we would be continuing to talk as the credits rolled, and then our voices would just fade out
Yes. And
go to the commercial and then the next program. How come there aren't, like, goodbyes and a formal ending on your show?
I'm very impressed with your questions, Terry. I hate to waste the time. I think a long crawl with credits and the exhaustingly prolonged applause is unfair to the audience and a terrible waste of time. This is a precious moments here. This is a magnificent privilege we have. We are making decisions about who gets on this street corner with thousands and thousands and occasionally millions and millions of people watching. To take a long time by kissing a baby, waving a flag, and thanking everybody seems to me wasteful, redundant, not necessary, and depriving of what may be a gem of wisdom from the studio audience at that last moment that you give that person to stand up. And also I feel a little guilty when I realize there are so many hands out there that I didn't get to. So if I've got 17 seconds, I can use it to get someone in, and they'll feel better about having come to the show.
That was Phil Donahue, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Donahue's latest book, The Human Animal, is published by Simon & Schuster.